So for the last lecture of the course, I'll talk about axions. And yesterday, I spoke about the QCD theta term, and that if you shift your left and right handed fermions in ways that are different from each other, you end up shifting the effective theta term. And what's usually done is you start with some quark masses, and you arrange to make those quark masses real. And in the course of making those quark masses real, you end up shifting your theta such that you have an effective theta bar equal to your original theta plus the argument of the determinant of the quark mass matrix. And we saw that in our single quark case, this argument of the determinant is just a phase of that fermion mass I wrote down. Okay. So the so-called strong CP problem is that phenomenologically, this theta term has to be less than about 10 to the minus 11 or so. And one might ask why. First of all, there doesn't seem to be any obvious relation between where this comes from and where that comes from. And I should also mention that if theta bar is not equal to 0, that means that your theory contains CP violation. And in fact, this limit comes from the neutron EDM that would be generated, electric dipole moment. And for this to be non-zero, you need CP violation. And that's partly why this theta bar comes in. The theta bar being non-zero means you have CP violation. And one way you could get rid of, one way you could eliminate the theta is that your effective theta is to just impose CP conservation. But we already know that in nature, we have CP violation. We observe CP violation. So there's no good reason to apply it here. And in fact, we've seen CP violation within the quark sector in the interactions with the W. Yeah.
So experimentally, is the electric dipole moment of the neutron non-zero?
Well, as far as we can test it experimentally, to within error bars, it's zero. But the point is, so the experimental limit is that this should be less than about 10 to the minus 26 in some units. And that leads to this limit on theta bar.
Right. So, but we are happy with some natural mechanism which gives us theta bar to be zero, right?
Yeah. Well, so that's the whole point of axions, in fact. So that's what I'm going to get to. So the motivation for axions is to set theta bar to zero dynamically.
You said something about the CP violation in the quark sector, but that's from the weak experimentally. So that's from the weak.
I mean, it is from the weak interaction, but once you've broken CP, it's going to propagate through your theory.
Right.
Even if it starts in the weak interactions, it propagates through. And in fact, from the weak interactions alone, you predict a neutron electric dipole moment at some non-zero level, but it's a non-zero level that's much smaller than what we can test so far. But because we haven't seen a non-zero neutron electric dipole moment, we get this limit on theta bar. So the idea of axions is to, the idea of axions is to essentially replace this theta bar in the GG tilde QCD piece with a theta bar plus a dynamical field. And that dynamical field is going to settle to the bottom of its potential. And the bottom of the potential will be such that the expectation value of that field is going to cancel off the theta bar. OK. So first of all, we need to get a dynamical field into the QCD theta term. And we also want this field to be light. If this field is light, not being light would correspond to having a fairly steep potential. And if you don't have a fairly steep potential, you typically have a minimum that doesn't set your theta to be zero close enough. So the so I'm going to give you a toy model to show you how one might get an axion. There are other axion models, but I'm going to show you one specific one. So I'm going to write down a theory where I add to QCD a new quark and a new complex scalar. So this should be familiar. Okay, so I'm going to add to QCD a new quark, and by new quark, I just mean some new field that has that's a color triplet. But I'm also going to assume that it's an SE2 left singlet and has zero electric charge. And for this potential, I'm going to take this potential to be minus mu squared phi squared plus lambda over 2 pi to the fourth. And this potential, this is one I think we all know and love, this potential implies that phi gets an expectation value. And we can expand around various vacua, but I'm going to expand around the zero phase vacuum. And that means I'm going to rewrite phi this way. So this F is the VEV of phi. And suppose this F is very big. So we're going to assume that the VEV is such that F is much, much bigger than the weak scale. So we're primarily interested in this theory at low energies, at least at energies that aren't too much bigger than the weak scale. So we want to get rid of the heavy fields. So getting rid of the heavy fields is going to do a few things. But if I just look at the theory of scalars, the potential doesn't depend on A. But I do have a kinetic term. And this kinetic term is going to generate a kinetic term for A, plus possibly some other stuff. And if I look at H, H is going to come into the potential. But we're going to find that H gets a mass on the order of the VEV. So we get rid of H. And the other thing is, when I plug the VEV in here, these quarks are going to become really heavy. They're going to get a big mass. So the implications of this are H, psi left, right, become heavy. So we want to integrate them out, or in other words, get rid of the heavy stuff. And one trick for doing this is to take a look at the symmetries of the theory. So first of all, if we look at this theory in its original form, it has a global UN symmetry. And that global UN symmetry is this way, psi L goes to E to the I gamma over 2 phi. Oops, that should be psi L. Psi right goes to e to the minus I, gamma over 2, psi right, and phi goes to e to the I, gamma phi. So at least if I look at my Lagrangian up there, things seem pretty good. I have, if you look at the Yukawa couplings, the Yukawa couplings are explicitly invariant under these transformations. And my potential is obviously explicitly invariant under the transformations. But there's one fly in the ointment. There's one subtlety. One thing that comes up is that when I do this transformation on the fermion fields, I also get a non-zero Jacobian in my path integral measure for the fermions. And that actually gives me something new in the effective theta term. And for that reason, this actually isn't quite a symmetry. So I'm going to put brackets around the symmetry. It's not actually a symmetry because I also have the transformation by effective theta bar term get shifted by theta bar plus gamma in the g tilde piece. So because of this, my full Lagrangian isn't invariant. It's almost invariant, except for this little change to the theta piece. Yep.
So the shift in the theta is due to the anomaly.
Yes, but the anomaly is completely equivalent to the change in the measure.
Yeah.
So the thing that's going on is exactly the same as what I spoke about yesterday.
Right.
When I shift these fermion fields, in this case, when I apply a symmetry transformation to them, my effective theta term shifts too.
So you rewrite the Jacobian in terms of
Yes. So this is one manifestation of the anomaly. It's not the only one, but it is one manifestation. Okay. And because this thing that looks like a symmetry, at least at classical level, isn't quite a symmetry, we say that the symmetry is anomalous. Okay, and one thing that's actually going to be useful in passing is that this theta bar term, we know that this theta bar term is just a constant. But suppose the theta bar wasn't constant. Suppose theta bar also transformed when you did this transformation. In that case, you actually would have a symmetry. And this is actually a useful thing for keeping track of symmetry breaking. We would actually have maybe this is a bit confusing. The point is that shifting the fermion gives me this, but if the theta piece itself also shifted by minus gamma, it would cancel that, and I actually would have a symmetry. However, the theta bar is just a constant, so it can't shift like that. It doesn't make sense to shift it. But if I pretend that the theta bar did shift and it shifted this way, and I would have a symmetry, I can use this fact in that anytime I see something that breaks the symmetry, I should be able to restore the symmetry in the sense by pretending the theta bar transformed this way. And this property is sometimes called a spurious symmetry. And then it's not really a symmetry of the theory, but it's a symmetry that you would have in the theory if you sort of played make-believe about what is constant transform like. Okay, so going back to our integrating out process, we want to get rid of these heavy fermions. And if I plug in to my effective Lagrangian, this V of phi squared It only depends on age, on the heavy stuff. So we can basically forget it. But the fermion piece has a slight complication. It has a coupling between the light stuff. So I'm just going to drop the H stuff for the time being. F over root 2, e to the I A over F, psi bar left, psi bar right, plus the Hermitian conjugate. And at this point, we want to integrate out these fermions. And at least at the leading level, this exponential is just unity. And that means that these fermions get a mass on the order of F. But we also have to worry that we now have a coupling between this light A and these fermions. And this can start to do funny stuff. So for example, if we worried about looking at what goes on at loop level, you could imagine connecting a couple of gluons through a loop of fermions to an A, for example. And this could, in principle, generate some kind of gluon A coupling. But I don't actually want to calculate the loop. So instead of actually calculating the loop, I'm going to be clever. And I'm going to be clever by doing a transformation on psi such that I get rid of this coupling. And the transformation I'm going to do is psi L is going to be e to the I A over 2 F psi prime L psi right is e to the minus I A over 2 F psi right. So at this point, I'm just redefining fields. But I'm redefining fields in a way that, well, first of all, matches the symmetry. But second of all, has a field-dependent shift in it. So at different points in space-time, I'm shifting by different amounts. So, well, first of all, if I look at this piece, I'm going to get if I look at this piece, I'm going to get this piece just gets rid of that coupling, so I just get a mass term and nothing else. But by shifting the fermions this way, my effective theta term, I'm going to get theta bar plus from this shift A over F. Times usual alpha s over 8 pi g mu nu a g tilde a mu nu. So this is the first effect. The other effect is that in the kinetic terms for these heavy quarks, the kinetic terms involve derivatives of the heavy quarks, obviously. And these derivatives of the heavy quarks are also going to hit these exponentials. So I'm also going to get pieces that depends on del mu A. But the point is that the only piece that I get once I make the shift that doesn't depend on del mu A is this. And everything else depends on del mu A.
So when you said heavy quarks, these are the quarks psi L and psi R?
Yes, yeah. So that's precisely what I'm getting rid of.
But the mass term for the quarks are generated through the term in the middle, right?
Yeah. So this is the whole mass term.
After the definition, that becomes the mass term.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I get a mass term before.
Right.
If I just expand this out.
Right. Yeah.
But it depends on A alone.
Right.
But my argument is that I can shift this A, or I can redefine my fields this way, and that gets rid of this piece.
Right.
But the only other place that A can show up is in derivatives. Okay, and one other thing we see is that one other thing we see is that if we treat this as a symmetry transformation by A, if we treat this as a symmetry transformation by A, because of how you define A up here, A just transforms by a shift. So these pieces, when A transforms by a shift, stay the same. But we also saw that when A transforms, or when you do a symmetry transformation, the when you do a symmetry transformation, this effective theta piece would shift. So as far as this part goes, a symmetry transformation on this would make A shift alone. So because A shifts on the symmetry, this piece shifts in the usual way, as it would under the symmetry. And we also see that if theta bar shifts in the opposite way, we get back the would-be spurious symmetry becomes an actual symmetry. So, but the point is that my story at the end of the day is now going to be my low energy effective Lagrangian is now going to be our usual QCD Lagrangian that we all know and love, plus some terms that depend on del mu A, plus this theta bar plus A over F, alpha S, over 8 pi, g tilde. So my low energy effective theory in terms of quarks and gluons, or in terms of light quarks and gluons, is going to have that form.
So the term in the quotation mark, that has coupling with the fermions, right?
So this is my low energy effective theory. And in my low energy effective theory, I have my usual QCD stuff.
Right.
So the QCD stuff with light quarks and gluons, the standard model, basically. These are going to be new couplings, possibly to the standard model fermions involving del mu A. And this is my effective shifted theta term.
So what I'm confused about is, so that the new term, which is derivative, oh, there is also a kinetic term from A from that original QCD Lagrange.
Oh, okay. Well, sorry, the del mu A, and if I want, I can lump it in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, A is a dynamical field. A has a kinetic term. Okay. So I'm going to try something new with the blackboards. Try to get the full dynamical range. It just works. Okay, great. Okay, so let me skip over. Okay, so we're actually interested in the theory. So A is going to be really, really light, we're going to find. So we're actually going to be mostly interested in this theory, this QCD theory, at energies where QCD actually becomes strongly coupled. So if you recall the kind of the QCD in a nutshell, is that your QCD gauge coupling, your underlying QCD theory is a theory of quarks and gluons, and your gauge coupling gets small at high energies. But that means that your gauge coupling also gets big at low energies. And your gauge coupling blows up, and QCD becomes strongly coupled at a scale we call lambda QCD. And this is numerically about 200 MeV. And now, instead of talking about a theory with quarks and gluons, you instead talk about a theory where your effective degrees of freedom are baryons and mesons. And I think you did some chiral perturbation theory, which is essentially the meson part of the theory. There's also a baryon part. And we're going to look at the effective couplings at low energies to QCD. And we're also going to try to connect up with electromagnetism. So this matching is a bit of a mess. So I'm basically just going to write down the answer. And I'm going to argue that the answer makes sense based on the set of symmetries I started with. So my effective Lagrangian is going to contain a bunch of pieces. We're going to get a coupling to electromagnetism of the form So this is the photon field strength. you can generate this kind of thing because you can have loops connecting the axion with this A field, which is going to be, we're going to call the axion, with quarks that carry electric charge. And these loops can generate this kind of thing. Or in less minimal axion theory, so less minimal high energy axion theories, you can also have some of your light quark fields also transforming under this U1. But in any case, you generically generate this kind of coupling. And you can also generate couplings to nucleons. And the form of the nucleon coupling, and actually the form of all the other quark couplings, is going to come in and depend on derivatives of A. So these derivatives of A, these derivative couplings have the form, all right, this way, CAEE, 1 over F, del mu A. So for electrons, our coupling is going to be that. And for nucleons, gamma mu gamma 5, nucleon times Ca and n. Okay, so 2 points. This coupling I can also get from shifting fermion measures. So if I shift fermions that are charged under electromagnetism, I'm going to get that piece. I also get it from loops. This piece, these pieces are a bit more complicated, but the point is that I want to connect a derivative coupling to some stuff. And if I take into account the CP properties, I'm forced to get this kind of structure. And one more thing on top of that, this 1 over F is what comes in to get the dimensions right. And these CA II couplings are typically on the order of unity. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that when QC becomes strong, it generates a potential for my A field, for my so-called axion field. And my potential is going to, my potential for the axion, do I have? Okay. My potential is going to be, I'm just going to write out the answer because getting it is a bit complicated. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to erase that. Did everybody write it down? Okay. Sorry. Okay, just a summary, CA gamma gamma alpha over 8 pi, A over FF, F of tilde, plus 1 over F, CA EE, WA, E bar, gamma mu, gamma 5, E, and so on. By CA, II, on the order of unity. Okay. And I also get a potential for the axion. And this potential for the axion comes from the potential for the axion comes from essentially this piece. And that potential for the axion has the form ma squared, f squared, 1 minus cosine theta bar plus a over f. And this ma is some number, m pi, f pi over f. Okay, so this is the pion mass. This is the pion decay constant that I think you saw in chiral perturbation theory. This is the F I had before. This is the big scale. This is some stuff that depends on quark masses. So the fundamental up and down quark masses. And this is the number of order unity. And when I plug in the numbers, this comes out to be roughly 0.6 EV times 10 to the 7 GeV over F. So let me say two things. So let me say two things. First of all, if I expand out the cosine, treating the argument as small, when I expand out the cosine for a small argument, this piece, I just get a constant plus 1/2 ma squared a squared plus dot dot dot. The other thing I find for this potential is that it's minimized when this is equal to 0. So this is exactly what we want to solve the strong CP problem. Because in the vacuum state, my A field gets a VEV. And the A field getting a VEV means that this thing effectively cancels. So what I should actually write is A is equal to minus F theta bar plus some A tilde, which is a small fluctuation around the minimum. And this A tilde is actually a thing that's a massive field. So we've solved the strong CP problem. OK, so this is all very nice, but we want to connect it with cosmology, and in particular dark matter. And the next question is, how does this field, this A field, how does it behave cosmologically? So first of all, I've implied implicitly that this F term has to be pretty big. And let me start off by just mentioning that that given these couplings and given these del mu A couplings, you can have decays of mesons to stuff like say K plus goes like to A plus K plus or other meson decays. And the fact that we haven't seen these meson decays implies that the A has to couple very weakly to stuff. And that corresponds to the mass of the A from these meson constraints has to be lighter than about a keV. And that corresponds to F being greater than about 10 to the 3 GeV. So we're already in a situation where RA has to be a very light field. And RA has to be a light field, and RF already has to be pretty big. Yeah.
So the constant C's, these are all the couplings which are of order one. They are not the ones which determine the, how strongly the A is.
Oh yeah. So these constants, they're order unity constants, and they depend on the specific underlying model of the specific underlying model that gave you your axiom. So the one I wrote down here is just one. It's a minimal one, but there are more complicated ones. And depending on the model, you get different values for this. But the whole point is all these couplings have 1 over f's in them.
Oh, what?
So all these couplings have 1 over f's.
Right.
So there is some model dependence in these values. But as long as these C couplings are not too tiny, you get basically this limit.
Right.
So the specific limit is model dependent. But we're actually going to get stronger limits from astrophysics.
Right. The other thing is that the FF tilde term that couples to A, the FF tilde part, is that like, a topological density?
It is true that this piece, actually, that's a good question. So yeah, it is true that this piece can be written as the derivative of a quantity. If this was just a constant, we could ignore this. So we can ignore it because in this case it's a boundary term, and it turns out that for a abelian gauge series, your vacuum structure is trivial.
Right.
So we can just dump the vacuum structure. Whereas for the GG tilde, because QCD is non-abelian, the vacuum structure is non-trivial, and you can't just drop it. The boundary term doesn't necessarily vanish in a simple way. But the thing that happens here, actually, this is a good point. The thing that happens here is that I can write this as a derivative. And because I can write this as, I write this as a derivative, but it's multiplying something that depends on A. So if I wanted to, I could actually integrate by parts and move this derivative onto A. So this piece is actually secretly a derivative coupling.
Right.
Well, so first of all, I'm forced to have fairly light axions unless I start flipping things around and I make my F really small, but then you get other limits because the axion starts coupling strongly and this whole picture breaks down. So at this point, the question is, how does this axion behave cosmologically? And for a cosmological axion, we need to know how it behaves at finite temperature. So we're going to put it in the cosmological plasma. And for that, it turns out to be very useful to have an effective mass and non-zero temperature. And in particular, for the axion field, if you heat up the theory above lambda QCD, above a few hundred MeV, you're back to a theory of quarks and gluons. So if you take zero temperature QCD, which is baryons and mesons, and you heat it up, eventually those bound states start to dissociate. And you should look at your degrees of freedom in terms of the quarks and gluons, which are now typically fairly weakly coupled because the typical energy in the thermal bath is about the temperature. So the upshot is that if I can also look at the mass of the axion at finite temperature, at temperatures much larger than lambda QCD. And here the axion mass has a slightly different expression. It comes from various non-perturbative effects, but it's on the order of I take my zero temperature axion mass, I multiply it by some constant, and then the scaling is roughly 200 MeV over T to a funny power. So this is lambda QCD. And this is some complicated non-perturbative thing that I'm not going to go into how you get that. But the point is that at temperatures much above lambda QCD, the axion gets really, really light. So even lighter than it is at zero temperature. Okay. And one other thing I want to mention for the axion, but before I talk about the cosmological evolution, is that if I look at this coupling is actually going to allow my axion, which has a non-zero mass, to decay to a pair of photons. And the other property I want to look at is the decay width for an axion to go to a pair of photons. And well, given this coupling, you can actually just compute it right off the bat. And let me just say something. This combination is sometimes called GA gamma gamma. And in terms of GA gamma gamma, the decay width is just GA gamma gamma squared MA cubed over 64 pi, which if you plug in numbers and you take into account that this GA gamma gamma secretly depends on the axion mass to the 1 over F, that appears in the axion mass. This thing scales roughly like 1 times 10 to the minus 24 inverse seconds times CA gamma gamma squared MA over 1 EV to the fifth.
So the definition of gamma G doesn't involve A, just the other factors.
Well, sorry. The GA gamma gamma is a coupling strength.
Right.
So it's just another way to write this coupling strength.
And so it doesn't include F either.
It does include F. Sorry. So this piece is A, F, F dual, times GA, gamma, gamma. Okay, so this decay width is 1 over the decay lifetime. And that means that if I compare that to the age of the universe, so the age of the universe, I call it T0, is about, it's roughly 13.7 billion years. So let's say 10 to the 10 years. And 10 to the 10 years, one handy conversion, it's actually remarkably accurate, is that 1 year is pi times 10 to the 7 seconds. So it's a handy mnemonic. So the age of the universe is roughly 10 to the 17 seconds. So if I take the inverse of this, that means that my axion, at least for EV masses, lives much, much longer than the age of the universe. So at least for lighter axions, I can treat it as being cosmologically stable. All right. So, yeah, actually, but before I get into cosmology, let me also just mention a few other, let's bring this down. So, but I should have left this until later, but let me just mention a few other things. So far, our axion has to be lighter than about a keV. You can actually get stronger bounds on axions from stars. So in a star, because your axion is very light, a typical temperature in a star varies from sort of order keV all the way up to close to an MeV, depending on the size of the star and where you are and so on. And that means that I will typically have enough energy in a star to start producing axions, given this limit. That's the first point. The other thing is that these axion couplings, because these axion couplings are very weak. And that means that in many cases, when you produce an axion, the axions can escape from the star. And depending on the kind of star, this can have a really big effect on the evolution of the star. So as you all know, stars are a balance between gravitational pressure pulling things in and a thermal pressure pushing stuff out. But the thermal processes are nuclear processes. And those processes themselves happen very quickly. But the thing that really, the reason that the energy produced by those nuclear processes supports the star is that the heat that you produce from the nuclear fusion reactions just can't get out. And because you all have all this trapped heat, that makes your star very long-lived. And it is essentially the reason why stars live a long time. With axions, if you start producing axions and axions start flowing out of the star, that gives stars a way to dump that heat. And that means that stars, in a lot of cases, can start to burn a lot faster than they would without axions. So given the fact that certain stars have, you can say they've been around for a certain amount of time, or so on, you can actually rule out various ranges of axions for various kinds of stars. There's also a happy medium, in the sense that these couplings go like 1 over f. And it turns out that on the one hand, if you couple too strongly, then the axion doesn't leave the star. So even though you might produce a lot of axions, the axion gets trapped in the star. On the other hand, if you interact too weakly, even though the axions would be able to get out of the star really easily, you just don't produce very many of them. So there's a happy medium for different kinds of stars for which axions can, in some sense, mess them up. And if I put the various limits together, you also have limits from supernova cooling. But the upshot is that these stellar bounds combined give you force the axion mass to be lighter than about 10 milli-EV. So milli-EV is 10 to the minus 3 EV. And this corresponds to F being greater than about 10 to the 9 GeV. So given these stellar bounds, our axion is going to be stable on the edge of the universe. And that means it is going to hang around today, and we should care about how it was produced. And it's going to turn out that this is also going to let us make axions into dark matter. Okay, so I better hurry up. Okay, so if I look at the equation of motion for an axion, I have a tilde double dot plus 3h a tilde dot plus ma squared of t, a equals to 0. And if I look at this equation of motion for the axion in the cosmological plasma, this first piece is a damping term. And the second piece is an oscillation. And it's a slightly funny oscillation because the frequency of oscillation is also going to change as the universe cools. So it's going to be an anharmonic oscillation. But it's nevertheless an oscillation term. So we have that for one. But typically, we start off with large h. And when h is much, much larger than mft, that means that that should be a tilde. And recall that a tilde is a minus theta over f. So for large Hubble values, the solution to this equation is overdamped. And my solution is just A is just stuck wherever it starts. On the other hand, when MA becomes larger than H, my field oscillates. It'll be an anharmonic oscillation, but it's an oscillation nevertheless. So we have that for one. The other thing is because A starts off trapped, there's no reason for A to start off at the origin. So because our A tilde, because the A field starts off as trapped, it can be essentially anywhere along its trajectory. And more likely, we normally expect A tilde to be on the order of F, the size of its VEV. So a typical initial displacement is on the order of F. And that means that because I have a field very displaced from the origin, it can actually carry a lot of energy in that displacement. Okay, so I can translate. So the story is that if I look at the evolution of if I look at the evolution of A as a function of time, I'm going to start with some displacement, and then the displacement will be basically constant because A will be overdamped until some time, and then when the Hubble falls enough so that it matches A, my A is going to start to oscillate. And these oscillations will be damped. And eventually, I'll asymptote into to 0. Actually, sorry. eventually these oscillations will hit a fixed amplitude, and A will just keep on oscillating on and on. Now, if I look at the energy density in oscillation, the energy density in A is going to be a combination of the thermal energy of A, but also the oscillation of A. And it turns out that the oscillation energy, at least for large displacements, dominates the A density. And if I look at the equation of motion for the oscillation energy density, and this is the oscillation energy density averaged over multiple periods, the equation of motion for this, let's move this on, turns out to be ma dot over a, sorry, ma dot over ma plus 3h, rho a equals to 0. And well, if I didn't have this piece, we would see that the oscillation energy density would just redshift like matter. So this is actually nice because if I look at my my effective time dependence of MA, at temperatures much larger than lambda QCD, my MA is going to vary with time in that it varies with the temperature. But at low temperatures, my MA is going to be just a fixed constant. So at late times, my M dot A is constant. And that means that these axion oscillations act just like matter. And that means that, in principle, these axion oscillations can make up the dark matter. So the thing that's going on with axions is dark matter, but it's dark matter in a way that's very different from this sort of WIMP paradigm we've mostly been concentrating on. It's been it's very different because the energy in the A field, even though the individual axions are really, really light, and in fact, the individual axions have to be lighter than about a milli electron volt. And if this was just a thermal population, these axions would be very hot. They'd be very relativistic. And they would have messed up cosmological structure. But instead, what happens is that the dominant source of energy carried by the A's is in their oscillation. Yeah.
So the axions are also constrained to be take value in a limited range, right?
Yes.
And so they cannot. And I guess the initial value of axion to be m is kind of.
So the range is a over f varies between 0 and 2 pi.
Right.
So kind of the natural range for them to start off is kind of on the order of f.
Right.
If I assume just randomly. Actually, the other thing that's important for axions is that you also want inflation. And inflation is good because if you didn't have inflation, you'd have different patches of the universe where the initial axion displacement would have had different values. But because of inflation, you expect that essentially everywhere in our causal horizon, the axions start off with the same amplitude, same displacement. So just for completeness, this is sometimes called the misalignment mechanism the misalignment mechanism.
Misalignment.
In that the axion starts misaligned, in that it's not aligned with its minimum initially. So the upshot of all this is that we get an axion number density from the oscillation. And this axion number density, it has some, it has some built-in uncertainty, but roughly, it goes like, it's proportional to the square of the initial displacement. Of f, and it goes like ma over 10 micro ev to the minus 1.18th power. The 1.18th part comes from the fact that these oscillations are anharmonic, and for some period of the evolution of the universe, you had a time-varying mass. Okay, so one thing we get from this is that now smaller axion masses give me more dark matter. And that means that we actually have an axion window. At least under the assumption that the typical axion displacement is on the order of f. And that axion window is that your f has to lie between okay. I should mention that this corresponds to an f of about 10 to the 12 GeV. So you have this axion window for f. So this side comes from stellar limits. And this side comes from not making too much dark matter. And this corresponds to some range for axion masses between a millielectron volt and a microelectron volt. So axions are really light. But one neat thing is that this axion parameter is fixed in a fixed region, and we can try to cover this region using experiments. So let me just say one last thing. Unfortunately, I erased it. But remember, we had this coupling GA gamma gamma axion FF dual. It turns out that if you expand out the FF dual, it's equal to 4 times E dot B. And one way people try to look for axions is they take a big box, and in the box, they apply a very big, essentially it's a microwave cavity, they apply a very big electric field. And what can happen with a big electric field is the electric field corresponds to a coherent superposition of photons. And because of this electric field, I can have a photon corresponding to a part of the electric field scatter off an axion dark matter particle. So an axion comes in, scatters off the electric field, and produces a visible photon. So the signal here is I take a microwave cavity, I apply a really, really big electric field, and then I look for flashes of light that I don't expect, or flashes of light for no good reason apparently. So this is analogous to dark matter or WIMP direct detection. And this is the axion direct detection. And there are various experiments trying to do this. So one of the most powerful is a so-called ADMX experiment. And this experiment is actually starting to creep in on this axion dark matter range, at least in the case of QCD axions. Sometimes people also discuss axions that are not related to QCD. In which case, the scaling between the mass and the F term varies. But it's typically a fairly similar story. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'll wrap it up there. But thanks for being my class. I had fun. I hope you had some fun. And you have one more homework. So sorry, but one more homework. But it's mostly going to be reading a paper that I'll suggest to you. and writing up two summaries of it. The first summary will be a summary kind of aimed at other people in the program. So a summary of the paper you read aimed at people in the Psi program who didn't take this course, but who maybe know a little bit about cosmology. So you should keep in mind that they may or may not know anything about dark matter, but it should be very understandable and not very long. So I suggest like kind of three or so paragraphs. And the second part of the assignment is a very, very short description of the paper to someone you meet on the street or you're on an elevator with. So I once had the piece of advice that whatever you're working on, whatever your research is, you should be able to explain it on an elevator ride of a few floors. So there are like a few sentences just saying like, I'm working on this, and this is why it's interesting, geared towards someone who is not a scientist at all. Yes?
The like final state is actually a visible photon. It's in the visible spectrum, or say visible.
Oh, sorry. Well, I mean, it's a photon you can detect.
Detect, okay. That's actually what happens.
Okay, well, I mean, okay, so I'm taking it.
Right.
Yeah. A detectable photon.
Right.
Okay, so I'll wrap it there. Thanks.